This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Michael Monks. The ongoing saga of the planned music venue set to be built at the Banks continues. The project moved forward a bit this week when Hamilton County opted to purchase the 17 acres it needed, which are currently occupied by Hilltop Basic Resources. The price tag, $30 million. So we start the Friday News Review with Cincinnati Business Courier reporter and columnist Chris Wetterick. Welcome back, Chris.
Thanks for having me.
And we also have with us WVXU reporter Jay Hanselman. Hi, Jay.
Hey there.
And you can join our conversation at 513-419-7100, email talk@wvxu.org, or find us on Facebook or Twitter. We'll look for your comments and tweets and get some of those into the show as well. Okay, so we have you guys on periodically to talk about this. It used to be the soccer stadium at Fall Lake we were talking about all the time, and now it's sort of transitioned into this being the gift that keeps giving because it's an ongoing topic. So the music
basically thing, anything between the city and the county is a gift that keeps on giving.
Yeah, we even talked about that last time you were on, about the weirdness that goes on there, and some of that is at play here. But it looks like we saw some movement, Chris, in a forward direction for those hoping to see a music venue at the Banks.
Right, right. Basically, the county said, all right, we're done trying to work with the city on this. And so we will buy Hilltop for, and just to say it's $29,750,000. That seems to be very important to some people.
Oh, should I not have said 30 million?
No, you're fine.
Broadcasters always wrong.
Rounding up is okay, but not necessarily for everyone, apparently. So they're going to buy the Hilltop site and move them out gradually. At first, they will take, I believe it's, roughly half of it and turn it into parking, grass-covered parking for the Bengals tailgating operation there. And they'll keep working on finding a way to move Hilltop. We don't know where or when that would happen, but when it does, they will move they'll take over the rest of the site and make it into green-covered parking, and this will allow the music venue to go forward, or so we think.
And you both do such a good job of reporting on this and explaining this and other issues that are taking place. But, I mean, just in that explanation alone, you have the county, you have the city, you have this business, Hilltop, you have the Bengals who are involved here. There's so many moving parts. And Jay, just for our listeners' sake, one more time, where do all these players fit in this discussion?
Well, the city and the county, a long time ago in a galaxy far, far away.
I get that reference.
They had an agreement to develop the Banks, the land between the two stadiums. And there were basic, covenants and codicils and all that good stuff about what could be built there. And as part of that, the Bengals had veto power on what could be built or how tall it could be built next to their stadium. So in order for them to sign off on this music venue, they use the surface parking lots there now for tailgating. And so last year, the county and the Bengals reached an agreement that, okay, we'll let you have those parking lots to build the music venue, but you need to move our tailgating to some other location. They decided, we'll see if we can buy the Hilltop site. So that's how the Bengals play into this.
Okay. And so it took some discussing, obviously. This was the topic of many meetings.
I was going to say it was like 6 to 9 months. It was a lengthy negotiation.
Right.
And so what happens to Hilltop now? You mentioned, Chris, that they're going to occupy half of it, but is that a temporary solution for them while they look for somewhere else?
Right, right. The county wants to get moving on this music venue. So they said, all right, well, we're going to quit trying to move you to Queensgate because the city has basically said no to that. And we will find a way to move you somewhere else at some other time. And there's deadlines for that agreement or whatever, the purchase agreement between the county and Hilltop. I believe they have to move the whole thing by 2021.
January of 2021.
Yeah, my memory serves. And that's the plan. Hilltop, uses more than half the site now. They will consolidate to about half the site. They'll move. There's a little part of their operation that's going to kind of move to Anderson Township. It's not going to affect it's not going to affect things. They're still going to be able to do everything they do, but they're going to move part of it to Anderson Township. And so the search will continue for a new site. And of course, that's being held confidential because if people know you want to buy their land, they are going to increase the price,
And one thing the plan that they announced this week, it actually advances the parking on the site because originally the agreement with the Bengals, they didn't have to provide that until the beginning of the 2021 NFL season, since they're going to actually take possession of about 7 acres on, presumably on January the 1st. there by the summer, that green parking will be available on 7 acres of the Hilltop site. So that's been advanced by 1 year.
And this was all signed off on by the Bengals, right? They've been cooperative, according to the county, on this in terms of kind of, you know, making some adjustments on their expectations.
So does this count as a win for the Bengals in an otherwise gloomy season?
Yes, they think so. They said as much in a statement to the reporters earlier this week, and the county views it as a win. So,
Jay, what's the point of contention between the city and the county when it comes to relocating Hilltop or assisting that company move to a place like Queensgate? We've heard some Price Hill locations, I think, floated around as well.
I think there's been a couple of things. Number one, I think from the mayor's point of view, is he doesn't think that the county, for the Bengals' benefit, should pay to move Hilltop. And essentially, the Bengals, in their lease agreement that was signed back, what, in the 90s, the last few years of the lease, they were able to charge back to the county their game day expenses, which for the remainder of the lease would total about $30 million. So the Bengals said, all right, instead of us taking that $30 million, you take that $30 million and buy the Hilltop site. But the mayor is still concerned about the fact that there are improvements that are could be made under the lease to Paul Brown Stadium, which could total, we've heard, maybe $250 million. Those are being put off until 2026, perhaps. But what happens in 2026, the Bengals could still say, all right, we waited till 2026. We want our stadium upgrades that, you know, are happening at NFL stadiums across the country. So that's one thing that the mayor is concerned about, the bottom line, you know, for taxpayers.
And keep in mind, the city is not a party to the Bengals and the county lease. So he's inserted himself in a way that has kind of enraged some of the commissioners, particularly Todd Portune, who's publicly said, this is not your business. Stay out of it. The important thing on the Bengals lease is the county views that as leverage in terms of moving off the $250 million in potential upgrades. By moving that until that negotiation until 2024, at that point, they are saying, look, by that point, you know, we'll be 2 years away from the expiration of the lease. We will be in a discussion over whether or not to extend the lease and how to do it if we want to do it. And it makes sense to fold the discussion of stadium upgrades into the lease extension.
But how does that play? Because if I understand, at least they've got options for, is it 2 10-year extensions or 2 5-year extensions?
It's 5 2-year extensions. And that plays into it because, you know, the county is saying, well, if we can't agree to an extension of the lease overall in the 2024 to 2026 period, why would we spend $250 million to upgrade? At that point, we'll just, you know, we may just default on the lease or, and I'm kind of putting words in their mouth there, but they're basically making the argument, you know, if they're going to, if they're going to extend the lease, that's when it makes sense to discuss upgrades, not now. The other point here that's important is the county does not have the ability under the stadium sales tax fund to fund those $250 million in upgrades today. There's not enough money left over from the stadium fund after it pays for the current debt service to actually the original construction of these stadiums, as well as maintenance and any other expenses. They don't have room for it.
And the entire cost of those upgrades are to come from the county?
That is another point of negotiation, right? I mean, originally, yeah, that was in the lease, that the county would have to pay for that. And so if you're talking about a lease extension in 2024 to 2026, the commissioners at that time, whoever they may say, hey, look, we think you should share in the cost of this or whatever.
And just one other thing about the relocation of Hilltop, there was also some environmental concerns that I mean, I think the mayor's words is, you know, the county's trying to dump Hilltop in Queensgate, and so there were concerns about traffic and, you know, the environmental concerns and the dust that could be created by moving that to Queensgate.
And that's all very interesting to me because I took a ride on my bicycle to this site, and I got to tell you, there's a lot of concern about putting surface parking there, but when you ride down there today, it's more akin to a mafia hit site than anything where you would like develop a building. It's between two bridges. I'm unclear on what the city thinks actually could be developed there, and I understand the concern about surface parking. It doesn't make a lot of sense to fill your riverfront with it, but the Hilltop site itself, it doesn't seem to lend itself to the kind of development we've seen elsewhere at the banks. And the other point is the asphalt plant is near downtown. It's closer to downtown now than it would be where they wanted to move it in Queensgate. So if it's such – and I asked the mayor this on Twitter and didn't get a response from him, but if it's such an environmental hazard, why isn't being – you know, dealt with right now.
And I don't know if Chris followed up on this. I haven't had a chance yet, but there's also the possibility Hilltop, as far as I know, still has options to purchase land in Lower Price Hill and Queensgate. And as far as I know, there's nothing that would preclude them from going ahead with those purchases.
Is that private? Is that a private transaction?
It's a private transaction. And at least the Lower Price Hill site where they would do their barge unloading, I believe that site is already being used for barge unloading or could be. So they don't even need city approval or zoning change to make that happen.
To unload, they don't. But they believe that if they wanted to store stuff there, they would have to ask for permission.
And so let's elaborate on that for our listeners. Why is it important that Hilltop have access to river?
That's where their materials come from.
It comes by the river.
They barge them up the river and unload them and use them to make the, and I don't know the ins and outs of concrete manufacturing, but that's basically what it is.
And Chris mentioned they have a site in Anderson Township. I don't know if that has river access or not. But
I don't either.
But the point with the concrete plant, they want to be close to downtown because that way they can work on downtown projects and they don't have to truck concrete back and forth, let's say, to Anderson Township, to work on these projects. They're close to where the development and where they're using the concrete. Even like on the banks, I think there's thought that, you know, they would have a pretty good shot if they were to ever build a replacement for the Brent Spence Bridge. They're right there, right by the Brent Spence Bridge to provide that concrete.
I heard Price Hill mentioned as well as somewhere that Hilltop may have some interest in locating both of those locations. Did you say Price Hill and Queensgate?
Lower Price Hill would be like 4 acres. I think two of it's underwater where they would do the unloading. And then the storage and the actual manufacturing plant would be on, I think it's 9 acres in Queensgate.
Well, I only emphasize the point because I noticed an interesting Twitter exchange that you had, Chris, with Mayor John Cranley himself.
Yes.
You tweeted back and forth a few times, and he was trying to make the point that, you know, I'm from that area, and there were only three different Price Hills recently, I think. Can you just tell our listeners
the mayor made the point that growing up, when, you know, he didn't think of Price Hill as Lower Price Hill, East Price Hill, and West Price Hill. You just thought of it as Price Hill. And his point was that this Queensgate site, what's called the 6th Street Yard, which is kind of just a little bit north of the Waldvogel Viaduct before you cross over the Mill Creek, he is under the impression, or he believes, that that is the gateway to Price Hill. It's interesting, but Queensgate for a long time has been kind of an industrial area of the city, and it's right now the property that Hilltop wanted to buy to build its concrete plant on is zoned manufacturing for that purpose. So there's been kind of an uproar because of its proximity to Price Hill, but it's not actually in Price Hill.
I was going to say, the people that I've talked to from Hilltop said that if it was east of the Mill Creek, they considered it all Queensgate.
Right. And on the city's maps, that is exactly right.
Does anyone live in Queensgate? Are there any residences that are classified in that neighborhood?
I looked at it once, and there were like a few voters there one time when I was looking at election results. There's not many people.
I used to work for another media outlet whose studios are over that way. And the best part was Wonder Bread used to be there, and the whole Queensgate smelled like bread early in the morning. So they had that going for them for sure. Jay, what's next in all this? I mean, is anything else to be considered at the city level or the county level before this stuff starts?
Well, I guess, again, that almost depends who you ask. Somebody told me this morning from City Hall that there were two things that they thought City Council would have to vote on yet. A major amendment to the plan development that was approved years ago to develop the banks would have to be amended to allow the music venue. And then I was told that they would have to vote on whether to allocate the money for the base park that would go along with the music venue or accept the money from someone else to do the work. The county's attorney responded to me and said, no, the funding for the park was already approved by council in April of this year, and there might be some things that have to go through planning commission, but they don't expect those to be a big deal.
Well, we'll continue to follow that for sure. Before I let you all go, though, Chris, I want to ask you about the former Hamilton County or Cincinnati Park director. His departure, was that unexpected?
I think it was a little bit of a surprise. I think behind the scenes we'd heard of a little bit of tension between him and maybe some council members and whatnot. I think it was a surprise. They had a special meeting of the park board recently to approve a severance agreement, but he had preceded that by saying that, hey, look, I'm resigning. I'm going to go get another opportunity somewhere else. It's been great working here. I'm going to miss it, yada, yada, yada. So that came out first, and then the park board had a special meeting and approved a severance. Well, when you leave for another job, I don't know about you, but I've never gotten a severance when I left. So that raised some eyebrows, and we obtained his personnel file, and there was a description of a meeting that he had had behind closed doors. It was an executive session, just kind of evaluating him, and the upshot of it was basically, hey, you know, you need to get more work done. And we should say his name, Wade Wolcott, who is the former parks director.
And Chris tweeted about this first last week. But what I thought was interesting is when I got the resignation letter, normally it's a formal, longer type letter, you know, thanking. This was very short. It was like two paragraphs. And when you saw it was two paragraphs, it's like, that doesn't seem like your normal resignation letter. And then, of course, we find out then there was going to be a severance package later in the afternoon.
Never a dull moment. We'll look forward to our next music venue discussion. Chris Wederich from the Business Courier and Jay Hanselman from
Right Here.
I'm sure
it won't be long.
WBXU.
Next week.
Thanks for both of you being here. Cincinnati City Council adopted a new law this week banning discrimination based on natural hairstyles. One area school district is dropping King and Queen from its royal titles at events like Homecoming. And local college students are helping the city of Hamilton redesign one of its neighborhoods. This is the Friday News Review on Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. Thanks for listening to Cincinnati Edition on demand. Did you know you can have the show delivered straight to your smartphone every day? Just go to your favorite podcast listening app, search Cincinnati Edition, and subscribe. You'll be able to keep up with all our great conversations with newsmakers, public officials, and other interesting people from the greater Cincinnati region and beyond on the go, anytime, anywhere. It's great for those days you can't tune in to catch us live. Weekdays at noon on 91.7 WVXU. And this is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Michael Monks. The city of Cincinnati this week adopted new legislation banning discrimination based on natural hairstyles. The move coincidentally followed a story out of Michigan that garnered national attention when an African-American girl in third grade was made to feel singled out when she was denied the opportunity to have her school photo taken because of her hair. The Friday News Review continues now with Cincinnati Inquirer, education and family coach and columnist Byron McCauley. Welcome back, Byron.
Hi. Thank you, Michael.
And joining us on the phone is Washington Post national reporter Kim Bellware. Kim, thanks for being here with us.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
Absolutely. Kim, I do want to start with you before we get to the local legislation here in Cincinnati, because as the national correspondent at The Washington Post, you wrote about this case out of Michigan, which is a recent example of what Cincinnati city leaders were talking about in adopting the legislation. You wrote about a third grader in Michigan, 8 years old. She felt singled out after being denied a school photo because of her hairstyle. What can you tell us about this story?
Yeah, so Marion Scott's parents did her hair for picture day in a way that they thought would make her feel good, that they thought did, you know, they looked, it looked nice. Her mother, who I spoke with last night, Latoya Howard, you know, she did her hair at home. They sent her off to school, and when it was time to take the pictures, they denied her the photo. They made her stand in the back of the line, the parents said, and she had to wait until she was sent back to class. And this is kind of the heart of what the parents are the most frustrated with, because they were not alerted that their daughter was, you know, not allowed to have her photo taken and was made to stand outside away from her classmates. And so now they are hoping for an apology and a change to these dress code policies.
Yeah. So what exactly in the dress code policy did this student what did this student apparently violate?
So Marion's hair was braided, and it had red extensions and some gold thread, and it was kind of all twisted into a bun on top of her head. And according to the Paragon Charter Academy's dress code, they describe it as generally one that favors conservative styles. And when it comes to grooming in particular, they say no non-natural hair tones. And that's kind of the heart of what the school said the family was violating with Marion's red hair. The problem that her family sees, her father Doug Scott, is that this code, in his observation, is not enforced equally, because they also have rules about the color of shoes that the kids can wear, because they wear uniforms. And he said kids wear all kinds of different colored shoes, for example. And so his question is, why not enforce that part of the dress code, but then enforce it when it came to his daughter's hair?
So the parents see it as a selective enforcement issue.
Yeah, they say that there's really no consistency in this and that it's not completely clear and it's not always clearly communicated. He denies the school's claim that all the parents were given a copy of the dress code. And they admit, they say, if that's what the dress code says, you know, we understand this. We're not trying to break the rules, but we do want consistent enforcement.
Byron McCauley with the Cincinnati Inquirer is here with us as well. And I know you're aware of the story that, Kim from the Washington Post was just describing for us. Can you just talk in general about young African-American girls and their hair? Before I let you do that, I spent a couple years working at the Head Start program at Cincinnati Public Schools.
Yes.
And a lot of African-American young students there. And gosh, they would do some great things with their hair.
Absolutely.
Can you just talk about the role that hair plays in young black girls' lives?
Well, I tell you, it is it's pretty amazing what young black girls and black women, too, go through with their hair. First of all, you have to you have the opportunity to wear a lot of different kinds of styles of your choice. But you also have to constantly, as we've been talking about, think about how other people are going to look at this hair and accept it, for lack of a better word, because that shouldn't even be the case. But with hair, the texture of African-American hair makes it really versatile. You can straighten it and it can be long, as I wrote in that column, look like Mary Tyler Moore's hair, or you could just wear your natural curls, which is sort of a tight, curly look that looks like an afro. If you look at an afro very closely, you'll see really tight, small curls. And as I mentioned, like Esther Rolle, who, for the uninitiated, that's the mother on Good Times. So she wore a short afro. But, you know, you have to really look at, and I have three young black girls who still wear their hair in different kinds of ways. Some like the braids, one likes braids, one has a natural haircut, one has a straightened hair. So there's so many different kind of ways that you can wear it. Historically, though, in the workplace, and this is why Cincinnati, it led to Chris Seelbach introducing that ordinance, and Cincinnati City Council voted on it yesterday in an affirmative way, is that the workplace hasn't always been very welcoming to black hair, and that's for men and women, and society hasn't. Black hair, you know, you've heard and seen a lot of backlash from having afros that might be perceived to be too large, or dreadlocks that are deemed to be, quote and unquote, disgusting. That's just a really onerous sort of thing to have to go through when you're just trying to get around.
And Kim Bellware is a national reporter for The Washington Post, who covered a story out of Michigan for that paper involving a third grader who was denied the opportunity to take part in a school photo because of the way her hair had been styled. And Kim, I'm wondering if in your reporting you had any comments about the way that these types of codes are maybe challenged in the way they approach African-American hair, and how it may be more challenging to apply to both Caucasian hair and African-American hair?
I didn't hear so much about kind of the challenge in applying those, but more experts talking about how it has seemed okay historically to discriminate against hair textures and hairstyles that are worn by black women and black girls. And when you look at who is writing the rules, you have to consider, you know, if it is a, you know, majority white school board or school district, who are writing the rules? Are they going to be inclusive, and are they going to be sensitive to, you know, texture and hairstyles, and what is their baseline for what they consider professional or school appropriate, workplace appropriate, because that's an entirely subjective evaluation. Interestingly, the parents said that their daughter is not the only black child at the school. She's among several, because their school had previously closed, and a lot of those students from the closed school went to this new charter academy, which had previously been more predominantly white. So I was not able to get a response from the school as far as why they continue to uphold these particular dress codes and what their justification is for, you know, why they do have to be this, because this is not the case at all schools. I'm from Michigan, and we didn't have these, you know, kinds of dress codes when I was growing up. But yeah, the big takeaway from experts is that there, you know, there's a long overdue reckoning with who gets to decide what is professional and what is appropriate when it comes to hairstyles and dress codes.
And Kim, as you know, Cincinnati just adopted some legislation related to this, but in your reporting, you noted that New York and California have what is known as a Crown Act, and Crown is an acronym for Create a Respectful and Open Workplace for Natural Hair. Can you tell us at all how that type of law came to be?
I'm a little thin on the history of this, but in general, it did come from people facing discrimination, usually in the workplace, you know, as far as being singled out, maybe being denied promotions, or, you know, in general, facing some kind of harassment because people were wearing natural hairstyles or they were wearing braids, locks, what have you. We've seen this in the military, too, and it's, you know, these two states were successful in getting something on the books, at least as it applies to workplaces. It hasn't quite extended to all schools because of the different funding sources. You know, certain parochial schools, for example, might be exempt more so than a public school. But this generally stems from a litany of complaints that had been filed over the years from Black men and women who said they had faced discrimination and harassment over their natural hairstyles.
And Kim, I apologize for putting you on the spot and asking you to explain some legislation. I only brought it up. You were able to quote Wendy Green, a law professor at Washington Lee School of Law, and noted that she was an expert in helping those legislatures craft that legislation. So thank you for your reporting on that. And thank you so much for joining us today, Kim. We do appreciate it. Kim Bellware is a national reporter for the Washington Post. Thanks, Kim.
Thank you.
And Byron, back here locally now at the Cincinnati City Building where this was discussed. You know, to Chris Silbach, Chris Silbach is a white guy like me, you know?
Yeah.
What does that say to you that he was one pushing this?
Yeah. Initially, you know, I thought I didn't see it as first of all, a white guy doing this. It showed to me a cultural competence that he has been around enough Black women to see that there might have been there was a need to enact this kind of or introduce this kind of legislation. He listened to enough people who told him about the travails that they might have had with the acceptance of their hair. First, I wasn't going to write about this. I thought this might be a politician who's scoring some points. But when I looked at it more closely, and then when we had the episode where the Penn State alum wrote that really nasty letter to the defensive back who had dreadlocks, I really had to write something about it, and I had to acknowledge it. And then I talked to my own daughter who wears a short afro, and she said, yes, you know, she went to school away from Cincinnati, and she's back here now, and she told me that her hair, you know, is more of an issue than it was, and she went to college in Chicago, and she feels that it's more of an issue, and she actually had a conversation about her hair with someone else just the other day, that it may not have turned out as well as she thought it might turn out, you know? And I started thinking about this, and I thought about the history of hair in my own family and, you know, women coming to my mother's house and they're sitting in our kitchen and they're straightening their hair with these hot combs and I'm smelling all these smells and I'm thinking, my goodness, that is really something to go through. Now, when we're talking about straightening, that's literally the taking of a hot comb and straightening a hair until it's straight, sort of like the texture of a Caucasian woman's hair, which is, you know, again, what I wrote about. So it is a challenge. And I think that we have to make sure that anyone who chooses to wear a natural hairstyle in the workplace feel like they're supported and don't have to feel like they are not equipped to do their best work because of their hair.
And before we move on to the next question, you referenced a Penn State player, and I just, for any listener that might not understand, there was something that really went viral on Twitter. Was it this week?
That's right.
After last week's game,
yeah,
a Penn State football player who wears his hair. Does he? Is it dreadlocks?
Yeah. So it's shoulder length dreadlocks, and a person who graduated from Penn State in 1966 wrote him a note, one page note. But in that note, he talked about how he misses the clean-cut days of Penn State, and he actually called his dreadlocks disgusting, which is what I quoted earlier. That was the open quote, close quote reference. He called him disgusting.
So can that be a remark of personal taste, or is that just naturally tinged with racism?
I feel like it is tinged. It may not be complete racism. I think it was, but some people won't see it that way. But it's not even the acknowledgement that there are certain hair textures where you can do things with your hair. That's a very popular hairstyle around the globe.
And dreads and cornrows, maybe in particular on men, are they more jarring to non-understanding people?
Well, it's possible, Michael. It's possible. I've seen dreads for many, many, many years, and I've seen cornrows on men many, many, many years. You only have to look to the National Basketball Association, right? And you have a basketball champion who wore cornrows last year for the Toronto Raptors, who now plays at the Los Angeles Clippers. I mean, he wears cornrows, and you look at, you know, Allen Iverson, he wore cornrows. This is linked often to the hip hop culture, but done well, done right, and I might be sounding a little bit prejudicial here, they look fine. Kim mentioned the Army and the military's new stances on short hair and dreadlocked hair, not dreadlocked hair, but, you know, cornrows and things. And I've seen those standards, the pictures, and they're short. They resembled some of the older pictures that you see, but you could just see the neatness. It was tied in a bun, but it was a cornrow and some other ways to wear your hair. That's an acceptance of different cultural styles, and that's what we need more of.
And of course, you're here because you wrote a column with the headline, "Go ahead, feel free to rock those Afro puffs in Cincy." So you got a chance to write that headline, or at least a story that was assigned that headline.
Yes,
we appreciate it.
Yes, thank you so much, Michael.
We let you run off. You had another column this week on a story that came out of the education community, and that is because one local school district, Milford.
Yes.
A suburb. Tell us what they're doing with the titles of homecoming king and queen.
Yes. So, you know, Michael, historically, we have a homecoming king and queen in schools. It's refers to inherently a boy and a girl, or a male or a female. Well, Milford High School changed their homecoming court to homecoming royalty. And that happened because two girls were the top vote getters for choosing the leadership of the homecoming court, which was traditionally king and queen, of course. Well, they didn't name it queen and queen. I mean, they named it royalty. And this is something that a lot of other schools that you're starting to see are doing. Purdue University did the same thing last year. And just last week, a school in Memphis, Tennessee, did the same thing, and they actually, they had a homecoming queen who was a male who wore a dress who came out as gay. This had nothing to do with gayness, someone being gay at Milford, but it was an acknowledgement that you want to establish an environment where everyone can participate, and I thought that was great.
Yeah. So was that something that represented at Milford just the outcome of a field race, or
right. Was
this part of an effort to be more gender neutral in the type of language they use?
Yeah, it's both. I talked to the principal and some of the leadership at Milford High School, and they were just saying that we wanted to make sure that since the vote came out female and female, the top two vote getters, and it is a popularity contest, students vote on who they want to be their in their leadership. They changed it to royalty, so to make sure that everyone had an opportunity to do full participation in the homecoming process, which was terrific, and I thought it was very well done the way they chose to do it. And Milford, as I pointed out, is a conservative town, so this might be something that that you don't think of in a conservative town to do something like this, but they did.
Well, it's always a pleasure to have commentating royalty, Byron McCauley from the Cincinnati Enquirer on the show. Thanks for stopping by today.
Oh, nicely done, Michael. Thank you.
And this is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Michael Monks. The city of Hamilton will start charging the owners of vacant buildings after city taxpayers picked up a hefty tab stemming from a vacant warehouse fire. Meanwhile, one neighborhood in the city is seeing a redesign thanks to students from Miami University. The Friday News Review continues now with WCPO reporter Jake Ryle. Jake, thanks for being here.
Hey, thank you for having me.
Well, tell us what's going on with this new ordinance that the city of Hamilton adopted based on some pretty devastating fires.
Yeah, so that all took place. It's really been something that's going on for the past year. So there have been several big, big fires in the city of Hamilton. There were two over at the dairy located on Joe Nuxall Way, and that would have been about a year ago, and then back in January. And then in July, July 25th, there was a fire on 999 Laurel Avenue, and you couldn't miss it if you were in Hamilton. I mean, we're talking flames and smoke that were shooting up in the air 100 feet high. So with all of that came a pretty hefty tab, as you mentioned, $210,000, $180,000 just to basically clear the building, and then $30,000 to actually get rid of the fire. So what basically the city is wanting to do is develop this new ordinance, and the ordinance is going to charge, or basically set up a registration fee, if you will, the owners of these vacant properties. There's hundreds of buildings in Hamilton that are vacant. And we know that from the fire chief. He spoke with us and everything about it. And basically what they're wanting to do is develop this registration almost to where not only are the firefighters aware of what's going on, but to be able to hold those owners accountable as well. So they're going to start charging them at the beginning of this upcoming year so that they can get more information on the books for the firefighters and then for homeowner safety as well.
And so both of the fires that you mentioned, those were at vacant places.
Both were at vacant places, yes. And one of them caused damage to six homes and a building as well, a drive-through building as well.
Was there any determination by the city's fire department or investigators that indicated the vacancy of that building is what led to the fires?
The fire chief and I spoke briefly about it, and obviously they have somebody under arrest. He's been charged and everything. It's a teenager. However, I talked to neighbors in the area, and they told me for more than a decade that specifically that location on Laurel Avenue has had issues for 10 to 15 years of people just going in, coming out, and really they didn't have control of what was going in and what was going out of there. And lo and behold, a fire starts, and it does a lot of damage, not just to that building, but to nearby buildings as well.
So the concern is that with these buildings being unused and vacant, they're more attractive to people who may be up to no good.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. And those people that are up to no good are causing a lot of people a lot of money that they have to deal with.
And the lot of money that you talked about, more than $200,000 between both of the fires, why was it the city's responsibility to foot that bill?
At that point in time, who else is going to foot it? The problem is that $210,000, it's coming from taxpayers. They are paying for the fire services. They have to take down this blight of a building. Who else is going to foot it at that point? So they weren't able to get a hold of the owner, and that was one of the issues that they ran into, and also a reason why they wanted to pass this ordinance and try to get it through as quick as possible. Now that they have this registration that's going to be set up, they'll be able to develop this structure to know, okay, if there's a fire at this building, it's vacant, we don't know if we can go inside, or we do know if we can go inside, and basically hold them accountable for what they're doing.
Have you heard from any of the people who might own vacant property in Hamilton with some concerns about this added fee?
I have not. I know I was reading a Journal News article, and they were mentioning someone who basically had an issue with if this registration fee happens, which it starts at $400 and it doubles every year for 5 years. So it's going to go up to $6,400 a year and then $6,400 from there on out. So the incentive is to develop this fee so that folks won't they'll either sell their property or they'll redevelop it into something else that's new. Some of the folks that are worried about it is basically the ones that are going to have to tear it down. You know, are you going to have to tear down the building? That's their main concern, because you look at a place like Spooky Nook. It's an old abandoned building, Beckett Paper Company, Champion Paper Company.
Right.
And if they would have torn it down, Spooky Nook probably wouldn't have looked at that facility. You know, they're using a lot of that old facility, that old just massive building to be able to implement it into their plan.
Yeah, the city of Hamilton is seeing a bit of a renaissance in its urban core. So I assume that this would be part of that goal, to get more people attracted to those properties.
And important to note, too, it came from an idea from the city of Sandusky. They had several hundred, I believe 200 vacant structures. And since implementing this idea, they've gotten that down to about 20 vacant buildings. So those people that own property, own vacant buildings, they're now using it and redeveloping it.
And before we move on to our next topic out of Hamilton, we should probably explain what Spooky Nook is, just in case there are people who don't know. It's pretty spectacular.
It's not spooky in the sense of Halloween.
Right.
It actually is this multi-million-dollar athletic facility that's going to be going in, not just an athletic facility, but also a convention center, a hotel, restaurants that are all going in over off of B Street, I believe. Don't hold me to that. I believe it's B Street.
Well, we're live, so you're in trouble now.
There we go. There we go. And it's going to be phenomenal. You know, a lot of club sports, a lot of your sports summer teams, your travel teams, they're going to develop these tournaments that are going to take place there. I've been told that there might be a football team that moves their facility over to Spooky Nook. It's going to be incredible. I mean, thousands of people are going to be going to that one site, and it's going to be unlike anything this city, Cincinnati, or this tri-state area really has seen.
All right. Something else out of Hamilton this week. You wrote about some Miami University students who are in the urban and regional planning program there. They're working on a project in the second ward in Hamilton. Tell us what it is.
Yeah. So they are wanting to redevelop this second ward area. It's basically a class that they sign up with or for at Miami University. And the plan was to redevelop it in the sense of not tearing down buildings or doing anything crazy. What they want to do is really tap into the neighborhood resources. So they went over to different neighborhood leaders, church leaders, anyone that you can think of that wanted to have a say in this, and talk to them and say, what does your neighborhood need? And for people who don't know, and I didn't know beforehand, the second ward is just south of downtown. So we're looking at like Pershing Avenue, which is one of the bridges that actually goes over the Great Miami there. And what they came up with were these really interesting ideas that are cheap, because you kind of have to be you have to think about the cost here. The city is not ready to take on multi-million-dollar projects in the second ward at this point. So these students developed a plan to put in possibly food truck areas. We're looking at crosswalks that are painted colorfully, and not just the crosswalks, but the entire intersection. And those can be done fairly inexpensively. Also signage for the second ward, just to kind of develop a sense of identity for this area. And I think, you know, you look at, you know, the sign doesn't even say second ward. It says a different neighborhood name. So this neighborhood really needs this sense of identity. And lo and behold, of all people, it's a couple Miami University students that came up with a plan.
Well, we'll continue to follow that one for sure. Let's bring in WVXU reporter and host of All Things Considered, Bill Reinhart, to join Jake and me here. Bill, thanks for stopping in.
Happy to be here.
Because we're going to talk about Blink.
Yes.
It started on Thursday.
Last night.
Continues on now, and you were out and about. Did it go swimmingly? Were there any issues?
Well, I don't know if anyone went actually swimming. There
all
were a
right.
few boats in the river to see the Roebling Suspension Bridge all lit up by an artist group called Mazzery, and it was lit up, and the music you heard associated with that came from noises from the bridge, hitting pieces of the bridge with a mallet, and the sound of cars going over and things like that.
Yeah, it was really cool. And if you get a chance to do a nighttime version of your daily Twitter post of the Ohio River Report, maybe we'll see a little bit of it if you take it from a different angle, I suppose.
Yes. Maybe.
Absolutely. But speaking of the bridge, though, the Roebling Bridge in particular, which is part of the show and obviously connects Cincinnati to Covington, where the show has expanded this year, there were some traffic problems, even though cars weren't allowed.
I just got off the phone with Covington City Manager, and what had happened last night was you've got the two walkways on either side of the roadway, and then you've got the main deck, the bridge decking, and there were people on each walkway and on the main decking, and they were not supposed to be on the main decking. By the time police realized they were not supposed to be on the main decking, it was, you know, getting a little late, and people were thought, well, there was a lot of confusion, and some people were upset, but the original plan was people were not supposed to be walking on the main deck of the Roebling Suspension Bridge, and so they are going to enforce it tonight, tomorrow, and Sunday night.
We've had a couple of issues with the suspension bridge recently, whether it be the bootleg cab that crashed into it, causing some structural problems. Then we had some other structural problems.
Sandstone
with the granny
falling
panties
earlier this year. Yeah. And then we got the granny panties, which don't seem to be, they don't seem to be upsetting the view.
Not at all. And you know, it's interesting because every time that something shuts it down, the transportation department in Kentucky is like, please don't go on that. And it's just as bees and honey drown, you know, they just can't stay off of that thing. I wonder why. Did you see something out there last night while you were walking around that particularly moved you or that you thought was particularly awesome?
The two pieces that really affected me, Cincinnatus, right there at Vine and Central Parkway, just, you know, it's a mural on the side of a wall. It's painted to look like it's 3D. The way it was lit up actually made it look real. If you're familiar with the mural, it's, you know what I'm talking about. If you're not familiar with the mural, go see it tonight. It's incredible. There's another one at Vine and Liberty, which is also pretty amazing. And I think I had been already overwhelmed by seeing everything else that I got to go back again tonight and get a better view of it, because I wasn't sure if it was an actual mural that was being lit up or if it was just a complete projection mapping. But I think it's actually a new mural there, and it's pretty amazing.
Yeah, the mural illuminations were particularly cool.
It's a woman on a horse with a flag, and it's astounding.
Maybe a Halloween costume idea for you.
Maybe.
Jake Ryle from WCPO is still with us. Did you see anything out there last night that particularly moved you?
I stuck around the area where Cincinnatus was, and it was incredible. I mean, you're looking at it, and they're incorporating music into it. They're incorporating, obviously, the 3D visual of the building. I mean, it brings it to life. It was incredible.
There's a short video clip on my Twitter. If you follow me on Twitter, you can find it pretty easily.
And who doesn't, right?
Yeah.
Well, I stayed on the Covington side mostly. I guess I'm
how
a
was that?
The right side.
I can't say that on the air, I suppose. But yes, it was great. And there's a lot of cool stuff happening in Covington. So if you did Cincinnati one night or if that's your plan, definitely make time to see both sides. What I liked was there were a couple of murals that were really beautifully illuminated. Covington has some gorgeous murals to begin with. But I recommend there's a mural at 4th and Scott Boulevard on the side of what is known as the Boon Block Lofts that is by the London Police. And it had been done a couple of years ago, but it is lit up beautifully with a lot of movement. And then by the artist group Thail, which is also a mural that's been around for about 3 years at 6th and Madison behind the Republic Bank building and the Donna Sawyer's fabulous bridal building. There's two that are connected. Beautiful. Don't miss those.
Can't see it all in one night, so
you really can't.
You got three more.
You got to take your time. WCPO reporter Jake Ryle, thanks for joining us for the first time.
Thank you very much for having me.
And Bill Reinhardt from right here at WVXU, thanks for coming in again.
Always a pleasure.
And you've been listening to Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. The producer for today's show is Elise Meckler. I'm sorry, she's new. It's her first week. I'm trying. I'm sorry, Elise. And our assistant producer is Selena Reeder. Our technical director is Josh Elstrow. You can find archives online at WVXU.org. I'm Michael Monks.